Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another Bald Move Prestige movie. This time we're talking about 1999's The Green Mile. It was directed by Frank Darabont. Yes, that Frank Darabont. He did The Walking Dead. Gosh, what? You know, that meme where it's like the world we lived in, if, you know, whatever. And it shows like those, 1960s Popular Mechanics magazines that have everybody living in like domes and skies, you know, everything's gleaming and energy efficient. The world we'd live in if Frank Darabont didn't have The Walking Dead ripped away from him in season two. You might recall that Frank Darabont also did the Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah.
He's a little bit of also did The Mist, which I think is going to come out later on in spooky season. We've already recorded it.
Yeah,
we're going to have a bit of a Darabont kick here. Screenplay also by Frank Darabont. He famously turned this around in 8 weeks with the help of an aging cat. It's based on The Green Mile, a serialized novel by the same name of the movie by Stephen King. He's done a little bit of things. One of the most prolific and famous and wealthiest horror novelist of all time. This movie stars Tom Hanks. He's America's dad. He started off in Bosom Buddies. We've seen him in Forrest Gump, Apollo 13. He's been Mr. Rogers. He's been the castaway. What a guy. David Morse, one of my personal favorites, who you've seen in Contact, Disturbia, The Rock, 12 Monkeys. Bonnie Hunt, who's been in Rain Man, just saw her in that. Jerry Maguire, Jumanji. Michael Clark Duncan, certified Bald Move badass, one of the coveted 1C physical champions. Because look at the man. Holy hell.
Right.
Did you know that just last week was the 10th year anniversary of his death?
No, I didn't.
He had a heart attack at the age of 54. Of course, he got a star in Armageddon. This was kind of his breakout role. He's also went on to star in The Whole Nine Yards, Sin City. James Cromwell, Star Trek, The Next Generation alum. One of the rare multi-character performances in Next Generation. He was Zefram Cochran in Star Trek First Contact. Also in Babe, L.A. Confidential, The Queen. And who couldn't forget his Emmy award-winning run in American Horror Story Asylum.
Is it the new Pope? Or is it the young Pope?
He was in one of the Popes. I think he was the mentor of Jude Law, but that he could have been an Indian. Yeah, so never mind. Graham Greene, famous Native American actor who starred in Dances with Wolves. We just saw him in Die Hard with a Vengeance as a New York City cop. Doug Hutchinson plays one of the all-time world-class assholes in this movie. He was also Horace Goodspeed in Lost, and he played the classic Tombs monster of the week from X-Files in two separate episodes. Doug Hutchinson has had an interesting life since then. We might talk about that. We'll see. Sam Rockwell. This movie's loaded, guys. Sam Rockwell. You've seen him in Galaxy Quest, Charlie's Angels, Moon, Frost Nixon, Iron Man 2. Last thing I saw him on was Jojo Rabbit. He plays a flamboyant Nazi officer. Barry Peppers. See him in Saving Private Ryan at Battlefield Earth. Jeffrey DeMunn, one of the Darabont featured players, most famous to Bald Movers as One Dale, the RV wielding driver in The Walking Dead. Also, Patricia Clarkson. We just saw her in Sharp Objects.
She's also a different character.
Very different character. She's also amazing in The Station Agent. And Gary Sinise finally plays a little cameo here, famous from Apollo 13 and Forrest Gump. This is probably the third or fourth time I've seen this film. I saw this film in the theater. It wrecked me. This is a very emotionally powerful movie. It does have a couple of pretty big flaws that I've become aware of that I'll talk about towards the end of the review. But I'm curious to see this. If I recall correctly, this is the first time you've seen this movie. It's a long one.
Yeah.
3 hours. It's over on HBO Max, by the way, if you want to just give it a gander and you're on the hot D wagon, like I know a lot of y'all are. What did you think of The Green Mile, Jim?
Yeah, I almost made the mistake of watching this on AMC Plus through my Amazon Prime subscription, but that has commercials
included.
I've I don't think I've ever seen that. They warn you. They're like, up front, due to contractual licensing obligations, this is displayed with the minimum amount of commercials. But
you
still commercials.
You won't want it. You won't want it.
HBO Max is the place to watch it. Yes, this is my first time seeing this movie. Somehow this escaped me for 20 plus years. And I was pleasantly surprised because I was intimidated by the runtime. Although the star power definitely eased that quite a bit when I saw who was in it. I don't know how I got through the 2000s without seeing this movie, because it's Tom Hanks, Michael Clark Duncan, who I love from Armageddon.
Come like get said, Papa Bear.
15 other people. Yeah, I mean, the pork rind this scene alone puts him in the pantheon. But yeah, I ended up not watching it. So this was a treat, actually. I felt it was really good. And I kept looking at this like through the Darabont lens, and seeing, you know, his patterns and the things he does and how he's able to create villains so well. Like there's one in The Mist that is that rivals Percy in this, but Percy is just he's evil. I mean, he's evil. It's like, and Sam Rockwell, his character, evil in this. Like,
yeah, two of the all-time great movie villains in this.
Yeah, Darabont just has a way of shooting these guys to make them seem singularly evil. So I was really into that. And, I mean, Tom Hanks is just great in this. Mike Clark Duncan, great. He actually won or was nominated for the supporting actor role in this movie, and I feel like that was well deserved. He did not win, but I don't know. I found it really good. It was interesting because the experience of watching this movie, I kept thinking, boy, there's a lot going on here. And at one point during the movie, I see how it all ties back into each other, and I'm like, okay, now I feel like the movie is coming together. But that was like an hour in. And I kept thinking, like, they've dropped storylines for so long. We're an hour in, and Michael Clark Duncan has only been escorted into his cell. That's it. And I know he's a major player in this movie.
Yeah.
How can we be this far into this movie already and not have done significant time with him? And every time I thought that, they immediately follow it up with a scene to bring me over to that character. Like, the next scene was a Michael Clark Duncan scene. And I felt the same about Percy. Like, boy, they really dropped that ball halfway through this movie. Nope, here's the Percy scene. Like, every time it's immaculately paced, I think. And for a 3-hour movie, it has to be. Otherwise, I'm just not going to be willing to sit through it. So I found that really enjoyable. And then, yes, like you said, powerful, emotional film. I don't know. I mean, I'm looking for its metaphor and allegory and what it's trying to say. And I think I see it, but we'll talk about it here in a bit. And it's pretty good, pretty strong.
Yeah. I mean, Michael Clark Duncan is halfway there just showing up on set. Like, you know, sure. John Coffey, this mountain of a man, this gentle giant.
Do they do anything to boost his height? I swear he's got to be wearing lifts.
Because James Cromwell is as tall as him. David Morse is just about as tall. Tom Hanks is a fairly... I guess they put him on like a 6-inch plank. And there was a trench dug in the set specifically for Tom Hanks to stand in when he's talking and walking.
Because they literally make Michael him Clark look 9 feet tall.
The way when I love it when they're talking about like, what's this truck hauling? Like it's axles, you know, wheels are rubbing the wheel wells and you see him step off and boom, like they just sell the fact that this guy is a fucking mountain.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it doesn't stop there. Like, I think Michael Clark Duncan does amazing work.
Yeah.
In just really channeling anguish and joy. And really just like a raw nerve. And then I think that's how he functions in the show, you know, in the movie, that he is this kind of like psychically raw nerve. I don't want to get into many spoilers because a lot of people probably haven't seen this film. And it's definitely one. If you like the Shawshank Redemption stuff that makes you kind of think about life and, you know, the nature of freedom and human expression and stuff like that, I think it's a good one.
And I think Michael Clark Duncan's performance here elevates it above the trope of like uneducated slave who's accused of crimes by white people, right? Like, and I call it a trope because it's so, you know, often used for good reason, though, right? I'm not trying to diminish that, but he elevates it above that. It's not just that. I feel like there's more to it because of his performance.
There might be another trope that even he's not strong enough to elevate it over. But again, I really, because again, I'm not cynical enough to hate this movie. I remember the very first time I saw this movie in a theater in a pretty packed house and how it affected people, especially some of these execution scenes. Because that's one of the things I thought was amazing is how the executions serve as kind of like chapter breaks in a novel.
Yeah.
Where they progressively get worse and more gut punching. But like up until the first one, you could almost think like this is just like an office comedy. You know, you got hijinks and nothing. And, you know, they're doing and then the first execution hits and it's like, shit, this is some real deal stuff that we're going to be dealing with.
We're
going to be dealing with the real deal.
It kept subverting my expectations too there because I'm like, OK, I see what it's doing. You know, it's setting up. It's going to use this first mock execution to get us in the headspace for when the thing actually comes at the end of the movie. But there were several throughout this movie. And you're right. Every time it's used in a slightly different way to say a different thing, maybe, you know, about the characters. I guess like the one thing I don't see a lot of in here is commentary on the very concept of executing prisoners.
Yes. And
I don't know that that's necessarily a bad thing. It's just not what the movie was trying to do.
No,
but it comes up in my head when I'm watching
it. It's definitely the second flaw that I want to talk about towards the end of this. But yeah, I think the way it's paced, the way this movie's structured, I read the book that this was based on because I was really excited. I had been a fan of The Shawshank Redemption for a long time. I had read that through the Bachman books. Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption. I heard that Darabont was doing it again. It had Tom Hanks. You know, Tom, Tom Hanks was like my baby's first serious dramatic actor. You know, and we talked, you know, we covered a lot of the shows that he's been in that got me excited for this. The Apollo 13, Forrest Gump, Castaways a little bit into the future, but like, actually, I think he did this immediately after because I read in some behind the scenes that Tom Hanks was carrying on a bit of weight because he was fattening up for the Castaway role.
And, yeah, it was like 2001. It was very soon after this.
Right. But I really love Tom Hanks, so I was very excited. I read it in advance, and it's an easy to read book. And I, you know, like I said, Darabont adapted this in about 8 weeks, but it seemed like a pretty easy job. Like, you're just streamlining a little bit, cutting here and there, and the way he was able to tell the story fairly faithfully. Stephen King says this is his favorite movie that he's ever had adapted, or book, I guess, he's ever had adapted. He's, you know, Stanley Kubrick couldn't get that thumbs up.
He had too many ideas in his head.
Stephen
King didn't agree with all of them,
and largely kind of name only. But man, there's just so much. And this is what I really appreciate is this is a full human emotion spectrum movie. Yes, it will punch you in the gut about as hard as you've ever been punched, but it's also hilarious in places. There's also just a lot of like, you know, the 3 hour movie, there's room to just watch people fuck around, you know, moving office furniture out of a room and hunting for a mouse and doing all these like but it's that kind of thing that makes everything work in that final act, you know, that you really feel like even though these guys are largely archetypal and they're anti-typal of like, it must be said that. These are prison guards in 1930s Louisiana, and they're, except for one notable exception, saints to a man.
Yeah.
The prison warden is...
Even the one named Brutal as a nickname.
Even Brutal.
Is a great guy, yeah.
Is not a shed of racism or sexism or anything to be had. But you do feel like, you know, if you're like, okay, fine, whatever. They found the five good correctional officers in Louisiana, and maybe the one guy was bad enough to make up for the other stuff. But you do feel like even the ones like is it Barry Peppers? Is that his name? Dean. He's probably the one you know least, but like he gets in enough that like you know, when you need him to hit an emotional moment. Jeffrey DeMunn also is another one who's kind of like doesn't get as much screen time as Hanks and Morse. But like they're all, even the guy that's running the switches.
Yeah.
By the end of the movie, like everything is designed so you feel all the emotional impact, and like all the story has gone to serve that. And I think the coda to this delivers a wallop. And the movie also just draws you in. Like it begins with a manhunt. And then it goes to like modern times. There's an old man in a nursing home running around bawling at watching a Fred Astaire movie. And it's like, what the fuck is going on? In kind of the same way, I guess, like Saving Private Ryan does a similar trick where it like, you know, hits you with this kind of emotional thing that you're not really prepared to grapple with. And then shows you by the time you catch up to the end of the movie, you're like, oh, fuck. So, yeah, this is one of this. I still think, you know, despite the flaws we'll talk about, I think this is one of my favorite movies. And it definitely I was wondering if I would if it would still deliver the feels. And it certainly did. It's a great looking film, I think.
Yeah, they recently did a 4K release of this thing. I don't know if that's the version I watched, but I watched it on HBO Max. So if that's what they have, that's what I watched.
Some incredible use of light and dark and color, you know, especially in dark scenes. Sometimes it's I've heard it can be a struggle to film people with black skin. And Michael Clark Duncan looks amazing throughout this whole movie. I think that like all the costume and setting look like they're just, you know, rock solid. The details around the electric chair are fascinating and horrifying and largely based on, you know, real life executions. And like I said, the movie doesn't consciously try to say anything, but like, I remember seeing this as a much more conservative person. And it's one of the things that started turning me around on the idea of executing people. Okay. Like just the machinery of it, you know, the fact that you can get things wrong, the fact that like, you know, and I guess that's the other thing is like, speaking of the anachronistically decent prison guards, you also have pretty anti-typally decent convicted murderers.
Sure.
You know, every one of these people have been spiritually shepherded through the process by the Saint Tom Hanks and have repented and are going to God, ready to stand before his righteous throne of judgment. Like it's that's a bit too much, but no, I think that it's hard to walk away from this movie thinking that the state really should be killing people. And
sure.
Maybe this is a particular barbaric way to do it, but yep. You know, if you read anything about gas chambers, lethal injections, there's just as many botched ones of those as there ever were with electric chair. And you almost always end up killing innocent people. That's the other, you know, tragedy of it, too. So what do we I'm trying to think about, like, as I said, everyone does such a solid job of acting, in particular Tom Hanks and Michael Clark Duncan. You don't often see Sam Rockwell play someone this evil.
He plays a lot of crazy people.
Sure.
Loose. He plays some dark people. I think like, I don't know. This felt very much in Sam Rockwell's wheelhouse to me. This guy's a lunatic.
Okay.
He also happens to be very evil. But yeah, this felt very Rockwell. There's a supernatural element to this movie that
yes,
the rewards patience. I would say I had a lot of questions going into the final parts of this movie that supernatural element sort of wrapped up in a nice bow, and in like a very neat bow too. It's like, okay, I understand exactly what they're doing here. Almost too neat in a way, but it worked for me. But yeah, so just be patient with this movie because it is 3 hours long, but it doesn't feel like it. And your questions will be answered, I think.
I think I was about to hit on that. The supernatural element, I think, is well done. It's pretty mysterious. It's very Stephen Kingian.
Oh, yeah.
And fitting in his kind of like good and evil system. And I thought the special effects, especially for its day, were understated and incredibly effective.
Yeah.
Like it really sells you on the idea that there is something cosmically unfathomable happening, and not in like a really flashy kind of way, you know.
And it helps that you don't know what it's supposed to look like. So
true.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like, I guess, it like a positive life affirming witch in that way, that like its magic system felt very solid, understated, and incredibly well done.
Mm-hmm. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which given last weekend seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah well, lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
Yeah. What else do we... Is there anything else we want? I mean, we've gone for 20 minutes. I guess we can get into the spoiler section, right?
Yeah, we should.
So, if you haven't seen this film, I'm going to give you a breakdown. Tom Hanks is the head jailer... the head guard of the cell block in this Louisiana state penitentiary known as the Green Mile for its faded green linoleum floors. And this is the death row. His job, as he sees it, is to he says it as a long term intensive care ward, that you keep these people calm. You keep these people, you know, taken care of, and you try to shuffle them off into the next life as gently as you can. And all the guards take that charge seriously, save one, which is going to cause a lot of problems, into this pretty settled and ordered way of life, drops one Michael Clark Duncan, who plays John Coffey, who is a huge black man who's been accused of raping and killing two little girls in Louisiana. And he's been sentenced to death because of that. But like, things just don't add up in Tom Hanks' mind. He can't see how a man so gentle, so friendly, so manifestly good could have been a part of these crimes. As the years and executions roll on, we'll get to know some of these prisoners, some better than others. We'll get to know the guards all extremely well. We'll come to understand the mystery of John Coffey. The movie goes surprising places. Again, it's really, really rewarding. And for whatever reason, this movie doesn't get as much love as The Shawshank Redemption. I'm not sure if I'd say it's the better film, but I don't know that it's any lesser. And if you want to say that this film has flaws, I think The Shawshank Redemption shares a lot of them. So like, it's not like, well, this is the one that's really this and that, and Shawshank is the one that does. No. So if, and I if you like Shawshank, and a lot of people do, we did a podcast on it a while back. I think you should, and you haven't seen this, if you're like Jim, definitely pick it up. Let's get to the spoiler section. Fucking Percy, man. God, I'd even forgotten half the shitty pulls in this movie. And the thing that makes it really work is that, you know, I think Louisiana is, among the United States, one of the more famously corrupt ones in terms of like law enforcement and whatnot. Like, that's just a reputation I've always had of it. Sorry if that offends any Louisiana law enforcement. You know, quit doing shady shit. That he is protected by his aunt, who is the governor's wife. Mm-hmm. And anytime he doesn't get his way, he can go running to them. He's got the power to break all of the, even though they all outrank him in seniority and command structure, he kind of has them all by the short curlies. And that's one of the things. It's one thing for him to be like, I think at one point Tom Cruise says he's dumb, he's stupid, thoughtless, and cruel.
Yeah,
it's one thing to be that, but also to be in a position of power over these other guys. Man, they play that. And this guy leans into the shititude of it all, too.
Yeah. Yeah, he absolutely does. He's great as the villain here. yeah, I can only think of one villain I viscerally hate more. And it's in another Frank Darabont film. It's The Mist. That woman in that supermarket.
Yeah.
Fuck her.
Yeah.
And fuck everybody else around her too. They're terrible.
Yeah.
Here's the thing about Percy though. I'm trying to like determine just how connected and just how, I don't know, because there's some nuance to the relationship here, right? Because they use a threat against him a few times in this movie, and it's, you know, the threat of like, he stood by while somebody was getting strangled in a jail. Okay, he's a coward. He's a coward. And we're going to tell people that you're a coward. I don't think that matters. I really don't think that could ever threaten a guy like Percy, because he's connected. And people who are looking for power and clout and influence don't give a shit if you're a coward. They want to use you for the clout and influence you have. As long as you're connected, you're still good if you're a coward or not. So like, some of these threats they were using against him don't land to me. But I don't know how Percy views them.
Also, I think that the film kind of leans into that. Like, they do their best after they pull the John Coffey scam and throw him in the rubber room to like scare him. Like, but they put all like, hey, look, we've got all this dirt on you. We'll, you know, brand you as this, we'll brand you as that. And lest you forget, we also know people, some bad people too, and we'll just have you beat the holy hell.
Sure.
But as they're letting him out of that, you can hear the other guards like, man, and he's probably going to talk it. So I think the movie's opinion is these guys are probably all fucked. But then Percy gets possessed by the evil gnats and things just kind of work out. The cosmic scales get balanced.
I like that. The ending is really good when it comes to Percy, because yes, he gets, you know, infected with this tumor or whatever from the wife of the warden. But like, they also, it's very subtle, but in the background, like when they're picking him up and there's like a cop there and maybe a doctor, they're like, oh yeah, he pissed himself and all this stuff. So like all that stuff they said they were going to tell people about him and threatened him with, they eventually ended up telling him anyway, which I thought was
great. Right. Yeah. Cause they have to explain like what the fuck happened here. You know, what could this have possibly, and like, I think that's this, it plays like a Greek tragedy. Like, this is literally a deus ex machina, like late in the movie with 30 minutes to go, they wrap up the two main villains with, again, literal act of God as the movie explains it. But it is so incredibly satisfying.
Absolutely.
I did think, so there's a couple things, because I haven't seen this movie in 10 years. I've changed a lot over the years, as a lot of people know. The one thing is, it felt like the movie's a little mean-spirited with the way it depicted his fate, which is very poetic. Poetic justice, him ending up as an inmate in the correctional mental institution that he was going to transfer, where he would undoubtedly torture
Oh yeah.
the holy hell out of these people. So he's here as a mentally, you know, like the Nats God went through and fucked up his mind, and he's kind of a drooling not their person. But the movie is playing kind of this light, ironic, hijinksy kind of like, this is a funny scene, which doesn't sit well with me. Maybe I'm just too. I mean, like, even a shit like Percy doesn't deserve this. The other thing is, like, did you think Percy is a little coded gay?
Because I wasn't picking up on that. No,
I didn't in every other. Because I grew up in a very conservative part of the country, in a very conservative family, and a very conservative religion. Didn't have a lot of access to gay people. I felt like he's a little coded gay, and maybe the movie was aware of that, because when he was into straight cartoon porn, I think.
Mm-hmm.
As what they caught him with at the end. So maybe they're trying to swerve away from that. But there was something a little lispy and swishy about him that I thought was. And then the fact that he's wet in his pants and kind of unmanly, he wasn't willing to, you know, the put his neck out to save a fellow guard. They were doing that. And I didn't know how well that sat with me. And certainly the joy the movie took in his final disposition, I thought was a little much.
Yeah, maybe I just get too involved in hating these villains.
No, but dude,
I felt like it was warranted.
Yeah, your first exposure to Percy. Yeah, it is you just see red, man, and it's from the jump. Yeah. Like, uh-huh. I thought, like, I forgot how that they don't slow play that at all. He's just a monster, and that second like, I love the way that they show the first execution.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like this somber, kind of almost sacred ritual, a sacrament mm-hmm. that they're doing.
Very respectful.
But then they bring in the doctor, and this guy's corpse is smoking, and he does the thing, and then it turns out, oh, he's not even dead yet. Mm-hmm. So roll two again. So that's even shows you, like, even when it goes the way it's supposed to, it's not necessarily the thing that it's supposed to be. When they get to that second fucking execution,
mm-hmm.
where Percy dry sponges Dell.
Yep.
It is. I've been to a lot of fucked up things in a theater. I don't think I've ever seen the reaction I've ever seen opening night at the 9 o'clock show of this show with a general audience. Like, it felt like an extended witness gallery where, like, people were sobbing. There was people like outbursts, like when the fucking blue flames start shooting out of this guy's eye and mouth through the mask, people lost their goddamn mind. What was your reaction watching that at home?
It was anger at Percy, certainly. There's a lot of that in there. But it was also kind of hilarious to me. I don't know. Look, I like a lot.
I forgot that you're fucked up. You got like the a lot of human centipede gene,
right? Like, The Thing is right up my alley. Human centipede stuff. Yeah, I'll watch that all day. But, like, so I was like half laughing through this as I was going, God damn it, fuck Percy the entire time.
Yeah.
But it's so over the top too. Like, I don't know. This is a big, complicated question, because I just have so many questions about why electrocute people. Like, if you're going to kill people at all, why electrocution? It seems so imprecise. It seems so drawn out.
But it was seen as the way of the future. It was seen as the clear, humane alternative to firing squads and hanging people.
All right. Well, let's shoot people into black holes to execute them or something. That's futuristic.
Collapse them through a singularity. Yeah. That right. would honestly, I'd sign up for that execution.
Me too. Yeah. One way trip. Sign me up. No. So I have a lot of questions, you know, about just why do it this way? Why do it at all? What the hell is death row for? And maybe we can talk about that here in a minute. But, like, yeah, I was laughing through the more extreme parts of it. Like, when it starts out, it's horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it went so far over the top by the end with the mm-hmm. blue flames and the smoking corpse and all this stuff that I couldn't help but laugh.
Supposedly that was based on a real life boxed execution that happened in 1990.
Really?
That this was an execution, and it had been so long since they used the electric chair, because, you know, we don't kill people in a lot of states. There's some states that are kind of, I guess, still proud of it. But that they had lost institutional knowledge that you have to use an all natural sponge and not a synthetic one. And they used a synthetic sponge for the prisoner, and it, I guess it went just like this. The whole, the blue flames, the smell, like it's it was a real life, like the people throwing up and just thinking this is holy hell in the witness area. And again, this happened 30 years ago. It's this wasn't like at a long gone dark, you know, period of our history. So
maybe it's not.
And it just looks like, that's the thing is, like, I think that they do a lot with us not knowing what these men are convicted for, with the exception of John Coffey, who turns out is totally innocent. But like, you think of like, God, what would you have to do to essentially be tortured to death for several minutes until you're essentially fry alive? You just burn alive from this electricity. Yeah.
It's crazy to me that they send it through the brain. I thought it was the heart that you wanted to hit with electricity. Stop that heart.
I think it's the whole thing. They take it from the top to your ankle. So like you got this lightning bolt that's going through your brain, your heart, your central nervous system, your spine. And I've heard that if everything goes right, even though the body is screaming and convulsing, that like after the when the voltage hits you, you're done. Like your brain ceases to function with, I don't know, 1,000 volts at 10 amps or whatever.
Your stuff going on, and you can't think, you can't feel, nothing. That makes sense.
But it does not leave pretty corpses. They even showed that with the first guy, that like his eyes like bulged out of a socket and his like veins had ruptured on his face, because it's traumatic to the body, whatever it does to whether you're aware of it or not. It certainly does a lot of, like, that's also well attested. One of the reasons they put the hood on the prisoners is to spare the witnesses from seeing, you know, your eyeballs exploding and you biting through your tongue and shit like that. So,
horrific. And then Percy is there, you know, after that first execution to examine the body and look at it and get all aroused by it. And, you know, I'm fucked up. I like seeing movies like this. But boy, if I was in that situation, that's the last thing I would be doing.
God, I was rooting the first time for Brutal just to break this dude's neck. And like, I love that part where like Percy was taunting the corpse of this guy. And Brutal comes in and is like, he's, you know, he done paid the price. He's square with the house again. Get your fucking hands off him. I got to say that if you're going to do state run executions, I would hope that Death Row is staffed by men like these. It's not. But you would hope that people take the job this seriously and take the human element of it to heart, that, you know, like, hey, we got to do a thing. It's the law. We're not going to take pleasure in it. We're going, you know, that this is already the ultimate punishment. There's nothing that we need to do to add on to it and add stress and endanger ourselves, endanger the other prisoners. Fucking Percy, man.
Let me ask you this. I've long had this question. Let's assume for a second that I believe we should be executing people for crimes, that there are crimes so heinous that you could deserve to be killed. Why do we leave people on death row for years? Why don't we just say, okay, we've convicted you to death. We've sentenced you to death, rather. You get to say goodbye to your family, and then we kill you the next day. That's it. Done. Why are we housing and feeding people who are condemned to death?
I see you've spoken to my father, Jim. You know, you might want to subscribe to his newsletter, because, he's just out back in a bullet. Okay. It's 25 cents and you're done. The real answer is because we have a justice system that allows a person to appeal. And in cases of death, where it's like the ultimate penalty that you can't, like most times you can let a person out of prison, you can restore money to them, you can give them, you know, damages. But if you kill a person, there's nothing you can do. So the justice system defers. Well, the appeals process just takes fucking forever. You know, like, imagine if you were allowed to, like, they talk about the fucking justice system collapsing if everyone just requested a trial. Forget about an appeal. Just if like 95% of the people that were convicted of a felony decided, you know what, I want my jury trial instead of doing a plea deal, the justice system would implode. So imagine like how hard it is to wrangle a death case where the state is deferring to the defendant and giving them every opportunity up to including to the Supreme Court. The governor can review it to get. So one of the reasons, and that's one of the criticisms of the system, that it's extremely expensive, because you end up having to house people for 5, 10, sometimes even longer, 15 years to go through the process. And it's 10 times more expensive from a legal perspective because you're doing to go through all these higher appellate courts. But that's why, because the
Death row is literally the place where people wait for their appeals process to
Appeals process to run out and for last clemency. And after everything's gone and the governor's not made the phone call, then they get the
why do we make that a separate sort of thing from just general population prison?
That's a good question. I think it's because like society's mores got caught up way faster than our system, because like honestly, you go back 150 years and pretty much like a posse would just round you up and string you up, you know?
Oh, sure.
Like you're just, you know, maybe you got brought before the judge and then the next day you'd get hung. Maybe you piss off the town so much they just string you up and hang you for justice. Mm-hmm.
Which is wild to me, like with how this movie starts and where they find Michael Clark Duncan, that didn't just happen.
That's right. That's another thing.
How he could ever end up on death row is crazy to me. But
the way this story is set up, because that's the thing, is like I was reading a Stephen King interview that talks about like why John Coffey is black. And we'll talk about this again later. But Stephen King's stated reason is he wanted a protagonist that no doubt in this set and setting that he would instantly be found convicted and without too much looking into the evidence. But sure. I was the same way.
Makes sense.
You got all these white dudes with hunting dogs and shotguns and like
literal
law enforcement that are probably 90% of them KKK members anyway. Mm-hmm. And they find this guy covered in blood, holding these mangled bodies, wailing. They just don't shoot him like right then and there.
Right.
Or lynch or whatever. You know, I think lynching literally means like extrajudicial killing. I always thought it meant like some kind of hanging.
Oh,
but no, it's just an extrajudicial killing. It's like I feel like he went too far the other way.
Uh-huh.
But it's like, yeah, of course they'd convict him and he'd just be dead. This is 1930s Louisiana. Come on.
Right. Yeah, but that's fine. They needed it for the setup and it's worth it because the rest of the movie's great.
Yeah.
I did think, you know, along the lines of the justice system here, I felt like it, letting the guy who killed Delacroix's mouse be the one to put him to give the order to put him to death is fairly cruel. It didn't really strike. Like, I know they're kind of in a rock and a hard place here, like
because they want him gone so bad.
They want him gone. This guy's a shit. This is the only way he's going to leave. Let's let him do it. But I don't know. And it's only because I like Delacroix. And I think this probably happens all the time in real life where you have monsters and not all of them, but you occasionally probably have a monster putting to death someone that they have a personal grudge against for whatever reason.
Yeah, for sure. I think
that's
like
question I have about it is why is the generator for the electrocution hooked up to the grid? The building's power grid. Why not just make that a separate thing?
I don't know. They mentioned that it makes like half the prison light up. So it's like I got the idea that it's like it's literally bleeding through. You know, it's like it's got so much power. But I don't think this is any. I don't think you need that much. You don't need like a fucking substation power to electrocute a person.
No.
You can do it 120 out the tap if you're standing in water, like you know. I think some of this was a little, because this is not a real electric chair. They built one that's based on one, and I think that they might have taken some liberties to make it. Darabont said that he wanted the electricity to sound like a caged beast or a demon that's being unleashed. So like building this thing up to where it's rising, the shrieking roar before they roll to, I think is that might be a little bit, you know, heightened reality.
And it's pretty effective when, you know, people are being electrocuted and the lights are glowing extra bright and you got Sam Rockwell swinging from the ceiling shouting.
That's, I think, the real reason, so that you can cut to Coffey and Wharton and all these guys, you know, bouncing off the walls, knowing that one of their inmates is being electrocuted. And the they are, you know, kind of next in line and they're all in this Green Mile marching toward it. Like, that's probably why. So you can get, and it's a nice visual counterpart from John Coffey's powers that, in you know, are giving life that also overload the voltage with a process that takes life.
Yeah.
And how it's like using the same kind of like energy and power in different ways, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I was introduced by James Cromwell to one of my favorite phrases that I only break out on very rare occasions.
I know what it is.
What in the blue fuck was that? Hearing the farmer from Babe, who has been like this genteel kind of Christian guy throughout the movie, hit you with the what in the blue fuck? chef's kiss of cursing on that one. Love it so much.
Yeah, it's beautiful. There are a couple of other amazing moments that I love. One of the funniest moments in this entire movie is when Tom Hanks is kneed in the groin right mm-hmm. after he's had this just horrible bout with his UTI.
Yeah.
And him just sinking to his knees in the prison and then laying face down on the floor.
Put as much of his body against that nice, cool linoleum as he possibly could.
Uh-huh. Yeah. He's holding his crotch. It's absolutely hilarious.
Never forget, you young kids, Tom Hanks started off as a comic actor. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while, when he gets on SNL and he's doing his David S. Pumpkins or whatever, you'll remember that. But he does a lot of facial mugging and just like in this case, full body mugging. And it's hilarious in this movie.
Yeah. Then Coffee, you know, grabs his crotch, takes his infection from him.
Uh-huh.
He goes home and bang. And he goes into the water closet here and he has just this pee session
Tell me you had subtitles turned on.
I did not. Why? What does it say?
The subtitles, when he first lets go with that glorious stream of mm-hmm. urine, is you're in brackets, urinating fully and easily.
And his face expresses that thoroughly.
That was an Academy nominated performance of someone urinating fully and easily after uh-huh. a particularly bad UTI. Yeah.
Hilarious. I love it.
Yeah. It's so funny. Something else funny.
Yeah.
Did you notice that kind of the interesting accent work here?
Yeah. I don't know how to rank this accent because it's a period piece.
It's Louisiana, familiar. But it felt very Three Stooges-y, like sweetly. Sure. Like David Morse says, like, we just got to accept how this works. Uh-huh. Maybe that's like a Creole thing because I feel like the Delacroix, the Del guy who was a Cajun through and through. And I guess he took dialogue coach. He had a lot of that oi kind of mm-hmm. to his O vowels, but it sounded very curly from the Stooges to me.
It sounded like it could have been a gangster accent.
Yeah, but I don't associate that to Deep South, Louisiana.
No, more the North and the coast.
It's more Foghorn Leghorn than mm-hmm. Certainly, but what do I know?
Let me ask you this: is there an implication that not only did Coffee cure Paul's UTI, but he also cured a little bit of ED that he might have had? Because he goes home and he bangs like four times.
Yeah, for poor Bonnie there just got hanked over and over again.
I mean, she didn't seem too sad about it, but
I thought, man, their relationship is so cute too. For middle-aged people still being affectionate in film. My interpretation is John Coffey infects people with life, right?
Yep.
When he does it accidentally, it gets away from him, and you get a Mr. Jenkins and a Tom Hanks situation at the end of the film. But whenever he cures you, I feel like that you got a little bit kind of like in Cocoon when the old folks jump in the pool mm-hmm. with the alien cocoons, they just get a little extra spring in their step, and it wears off.
Vigor.
Mm-hmm. Except for, like I said, when it gets away from Coffee on the two occasions it does, and it like more of him escapes than he means it to. But yeah, I think kind of like, yeah, that was like a minor jinkenings he got.
Gotcha. Maybe we should talk about that because that's one of the things I found most interesting about the movie is.
Yes.
It's supernatural element and how it ties into its themes. And its kind of thesis on life. And I found that was interesting when, you know, Tom, because the entire movie, I'm thinking this age doesn't line up. Like they've casted Tom Hanks. Here's what I thought happened. I thought the scenario was we've got a prison guard who's supposed to be like 20 years old, and they cast Tom Hanks, and we're like, we can fudge Tom Hanks maybe to be in his late 20s, even though he's probably like 35 going on 40. And then they cast his wife, who looked even slightly older than him. And I'm like, there's no way that these ages line up. This is just classic Hollywood,
right?
You know, rope-a-dope with ages. And the entire movie, I'm thinking that. And I'm like, well, it's just, I'm just going to have to live with that. And then we get to the end, and they reverse that. They give you a reason for all that to be true that made total sense in the context of the film. So I was really happy to see that they did that. And the way they wrap that up is, Coffee gave him part of his gift, which made him live extra long. So when you see this old man who, in my estimation, must have been like 95 years old, it turns out he's actually 108 because he's lived so long because of the gift Coffee gave him.
And the horror of what is to come, that like he's got this field mouse who is, what, 70? And what's the average lifespan of a mouse? Like a year, 2 years? And this mouse is still going. And he thinks, my God, what does this, what does this add up to when you put it into a man? Like, am I going to literally have to endure for hundreds of years?
I think they messed watching. They made him too old. So there's a balance here, right? There's a balance between like what is believably old that a man this age could have lived and had a family in the 1930s.
Yeah.
And what is too young that you would instantly go, well, there's something magical happening here because he's way too young. Because like, you know, based on the scale of the mouse age, I think he should look more like he's 50, not like he's 85.
See, I thought the mouse looked like he's a very old mouse. And my idea was it doesn't spare you from the aging process. It just is going to keep you alive. And that, because this guy doesn't look 108 years old, right? He looks like he's in his 70s. And maybe, maybe the mouse got more of it because John Coffey was truly out of control in that. With the Tom Hanks, he just had to get a little, you know, he was so overcome with all the shit that had just happened with the curing of the cancer and the, you know, being touched by the evil Wild Bill, that he had to let some of that evil back out of him. Whereas the mouse got like, you know, is completely different. Like it's like it got like a thunderbolt of it. But still, that's the thing. It's like at the end, like you really feel for this guy. Like, you know, you've seen, you know, he's like, I'm not immortal, but like my penance is going to be stuck on this planet and witnessing everything that I love or care about die, essentially.
And then you think about John Coffey, who had the purest form of that. How long did he live? Right. How much has he seen? How much evil and sorrow and pain had he seen to be tired enough of it to just say, I don't want you to fight this. I don't want to run away. I'm just done with it. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcasts, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
And now, back with more Bald Move.
We don't know. I mean, because it's funny, because, like, what do we know about John Coffey? His initials are JC. Gary Sinise says that it's like he fell from the sky, describing the fact that this guy came, just sprung up out of nowhere as a full adult with no documentation. No, it's probably not super uncommon. So I think that that's like it wouldn't be like, oh, my God, this is what the hell. We don't have a birth certificate in this guy or whatever. Mm-hmm. Seems like he could have been perhaps a former slave. But even then, he'd be old for that. So, like, yeah, maybe he's been around for a long time.
Probably.
You know, like if he's like, what if he was like one of the first brought across the boats? Like he could have gotten here in the West Indies in 1600s and been seen the very worst, miserable parts of humanity. Mm-hmm. Or he could have dropped here, or he could have come down from, you know, from God 40 years ago and been fed up because, you know.
Sure. And met Percy and been like, I'm done.
That's one of the things in the movie that, and maybe it makes more sense if you think that he's been around here for the sum total of U.S. slavery and the mm-hmm. Jim Crow era immediately afterwards. Because, like, one of the things I felt like the movie's telling is that most people are fundamentally good. And there's just a few, like, maybe born bad people. But, like, John Coffey's experience seems to be radically different from that. Mm-hmm. And that's like, man, I feel like the movie could have done a lot if they started to, like, critique systems rather than individuals. So I'm getting closer to my critique of the movie itself.
Sure.
But it just doesn't, like, you just, I don't know, he's just a Christ figure.
Yeah, definitely.
Plain and simple. I
mean, yeah, he takes pain and evil from people and processes it into healing good. I don't know.
And then dies kind of like after he forgives everyone there for knowing not what they do. Yeah. It's very, very JC.
Yeah. And there's this weird, you know, push and pull between like giving people life and that life being a curse in a weird way, right? John Coffey sees his life as something to be tolerated, something to be endured. And he's able to do good for other people during that time. But what is he giving them? He's giving them more life, which by his estimation would be a pretty negative thing. So I don't know. It's he's taking pain, but he's prolonging what he views as a necessarily painful thing, mm-hmm. which is existence.
Yeah.
And that's right. And the green mile is your life, right? I mean, that's right. The metaphor here.
Everybody has to walk it. Everyone pays the same the same toll at the end. One death. That's what you owe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the whole, he killed them with their love. And that's what the whole world is like. Again, I don't know that I agree with that sentiment literally, but I don't know. I mean, it made me think about, like, if I was a I sometimes think about this, if you were a psychic or if you were someone that could read minds, you're a mind reader, mm-hmm. Would it be horrifying to know how many people are fucking just evil and up to no good? Or would it be comforting to know that most people are just thinking about themselves and their families and, you know, what they're wanting to eat and the movie they saw last night, and that, like, you know, everyone is kind of within one standard deviation of fucked upness from the other. And you've got some extreme outliers because of whatever reason. But, like, I'd have always thought that it would be net good if we could read each other's minds, because I think we'd find out that we have a lot more in common and we want a lot more out of the world that's the same than, like, oh, Jesus Christ, my neighbors are fucking psycho. Like, I don't think that. But it seems like from Coffee's experience, it's the opposite. But maybe it's just that the negative things overwhelm the positive things. Like, the negative just gets so much, you know, like the best person. You stack them up and they're just walking down the street. They're probably not calling attention to themselves, right? But you get the worst person, somebody like Wild Bill, and he's like literally the center of every attention that he goes, you know? So, like, maybe it's one of those things where, like, evil just won't shut the fuck up and good is just kind of like trying to muddle through, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I look at, you know, his Coffee's situation, Coffee's lot in life, and he's kind of cursed with this ability to help people. And so all he sees around him are the negative things, the bad things. And all that comes to him is bad and negative. And I think that could influence his, you know, opinion of things. You know, he sees all the cancer, all the disease, the tumors,
because he does,
of people. And he sees good people too, but that's not his focus, right? His focus seems to be helping people.
I guess if you open up evil to the concept of cancer and natural disaster and things like that, then there's a lot more evil in the world than you'd think.
Sure.
I love the structure of this movie. Like I said, it ends up with this old man losing his shit at a Fred Astaire movie. And then the way that movie comes full circle, and John Coffey's like, the one of his last requests is he wants to see one of them flicker shows, and they show him this Fred Astaire, and the way they frame his head where it's behind the projector and it looks like just a classic Renaissance halo. And he's just there, just being his mind blown by these beautiful, graceful people dancing this beautiful music. And, you know, Tom Hanks and everybody just kind of soaking it in to him 100 years later. Well, no, 80 years later, like, losing his shit seeing that movie. I thought that was really good because, again, I'd almost forgotten that had happened 3 hours ago until they hit it. And I don't think the movie needed Dakota. Like, you didn't need them, but, like, it definitely, it's one of the things that sticks with you the longest is that, like, classic. It's sneaky horror, you know?
Yeah, I think I did need it. I had big questions about the age thing, like I said.
Okay.
I needed to understand that he was older than I thought he could be for that to make sense. Although, like I also said, I was prepared to just accept it because that's what Hollywood does sometimes.
I thought it was interesting that when he cured Patricia Clarkson, not only did he cure her of her brain cancer, also gave her a studio quality makeup job. It's his powers are such that it can take a lemon sized cancer out of your head and also just give you flawless brows, makeup, hair, everything. Just takes it all. Takes all the pain away.
Yeah. No, they had to make
it's a trip to the salon. I didn't understand some of that stuff, like with the Patricia Clarkson, where she gets up and says, "I was in a dream and we were both in dark." I'm like, that's the one thing that still remains a mystery to me. I don't literally know what the fuck they're going with on that.
I don't either.
Like, it almost implies she saves him as he's saving her. But, like, you can fucking do nothing, man.
Right.
At least Bonnie made him cornbread.
Yeah. The mouse, like, fetching the spool. I didn't understand that either.
What do you mean?
I kept expecting, like, somehow this mouse to be a mouse reincarnation of one of the characters or something. Like, to have it be so smart. I guess it was just a trained mouse. Was this like a lab mouse that escaped somewhere? And
that's a good, you know, I've never even considered that, like, above and beyond it having this long ass lifespan, it came kind of like a trained circus mouse. It was this tame, and but it came before John Coffey. So like, if it came after, you might think that like it was like they're a package deal. But no, I don't know.
Yeah, it's just a question, lingering question I had about the movie.
I wonder how this fits in. I've never read any meta-analysis about how this fits in with Stephen King's cosmology. I wonder if this does fit into the steam and the, you know, cosmic turtle and the deadlights. Like, is, you know, is Wild Bill a Randall Flagg the shard? Is John Coffey? Because, like, there are a lot of magical black folk in Stephen King's works.
Sure.
Features heavily in The Stand. I wonder if you're supposed to understand that, like, the old wise black lady from the Stand is like a descendant of John Coffey's. I don't know, because like I remember getting really deep, because you know me and lore, god damn it, I love it. I got really deep after the first It movie into like the cosmology and how this ties into like the Dark Tower and how there's a consistent satanic figure and all this stuff. And I don't know. It doesn't feel like it, but it does have those supernatural elements. They do. I kept on thinking, especially when he was taking whatever it was out of Patricia Clark's, that looked a lot like the steam that was released in like Doctor Sleep.
Gotcha. Yeah, I don't know. The thing that always blows my mind is when I see Castle Rock Entertainment making Stephen King adaptations, but knowing they're not affiliated with Stephen King. It's Rob Reiner's studio, but they, but also they're named after the Stephen King town.
Sure.
So it's always a little confusing to me. There was one other thing in this movie also that was confusing. Why don't they just tell the warden about what Coffey can do in order to, this whole plot, like in the middle, there's a plot where they want to cure Patricia Arquette of her brain tumor. And so they sneak John Coffey out of the prison. They prison break him. And they take him to the warden's house. And the warden is on his porch with a shotgun. What? Who are you? 2:30 in the morning coming up. I'll blow your heads off. They say it's him. And then they, and then, you know, John Coffey is revealed. And he's like, don't fucking move. I'll blow you up. Why don't they just say, hey, warden. Dude.
Yeah.
You've told me about your wife. I think there's a solution here. And it's this John Coffey guy. Let me show you what he can do, because you could demonstrate this. You don't even have to like say, trust me, he can help. Let's break him out. You could just demonstrate it.
I want to say it's because in the book, the warden was a lot more racist, maybe not atypically racist for a person in his position and age, but like pretty fucking racist. And he had to be borderline restrained to let this large, powerful black man into his wife's bedroom to kiss her on the lips and do all that.
Well, I'm saying, but
I'm not 100%
like,
sure.
Let's take it all the way back to
that, like he would just never
discover what John Coffey can do.
Yeah.
And let me go to the warden, who I know his wife is suffering, and tell him, hey, I discovered John Coffey can do a thing. Let's bring your wife here and see if he can do it for her. Or, OK, you don't believe me here. Let me crush this mouse's neck and show you what John Coffey can do. And then believe me.
I wonder if John Coffey would do that. Like, it's one thing because, like, you know, there's this whole like God's not to be tested, you know, kind of, even though God gets tested by faithful men all throughout the Bible. But you can't test him now. I wonder if it's something like that, like John Coffey would not be down with like a parlor trick to demonstrate, like it's like you either take it on faith or you don't.
Maybe so. The problem is they never even entertain the idea,
but also
it's just like straight to prison break.
They
and
have
like,
to,
that's insane.
And I think they could have just had one scene. It's like, you know, the warden is never going to go with it for this, but like, because it's a tall sale, you know. It's like it's this convicted guy who, like, I thought the Gary Sinise speech was interesting. That like, you know, the way he's like, yeah, I get it. That John Coffey seems like a real good guy, and it's just hard to believe. But like, you know, consider the family dog that bites the child out of nowhere, and what do? You know, when you're I thought, while we're on the subject, I thought it was pretty fucked up to use your child as an object lesson. Come here, boy. Show this stranger your mangled face. God damn, he's never going to see out of that. Oh, God, he's like, it's you're lucky to have the one eye, aren't you, boy? Aren't you? That's mm-hmm. right. Say thank you to God for the one eye boy. Now get out of here. Go like, God damn. Like maybe you could start repetition and say, hey, watch this kid. Do you notice anything about my son? Like, but to call mm-hmm. him over to be like, I need to win an argument with this fucking corrections officer that wants to trust John Coffey. Get over here. Okay. Do we have anything else? Because I want to talk about, I got to say, because I imagine there's been people screaming, I got to talk about what I think are the flaws of this movie.
Yeah, I just brought one up.
So we we've already kind of hinted around it, but like the whole magical Negro trope, if you need like a primer on why that can be offensive, there's a whole Wikipedia article that's pretty well, pretty good. Got lots of example. If you want something a little less stuffy, TV Tropes has got you as well. But this is a particularly pernicious example because this magical black man exists seemingly only to take the pain of white folks away and to mm-hmm. dispel their guilt at the things that they have to do because of the systematic nature of their job.
Yeah.
Like, holy shit, this guy is here to like take away our pain and suffering and alleviate us from our white guilt.
Yeah, it's not quite like slavery apologism, but it's pretty close.
Yeah. And the other critique I have is this movie is all about the individual and finding these people praiseworthy or blameless or critiquing mm-hmm. them and condemning them. But it says nothing about the systems. You know, in this movie, justice works well. Men commit these heinous crimes. They go to the Green Mile to atone. Tom Hanks shepherds them with his other saintly guards in with compassion and wisdom, and they just accept the justice of their death and they go into the chair willingly. None of these men working as correctional officers in the deep 30s South are, you know, share any of the flaws common to them. None of them hate their wives or there's a little bit of that with the warden where he, because, you know, 1930s, like they didn't trust women with checkbooks back then. He had the burden of knowing his wife was going to die of an inoperable tumor. And oh, my God, how can I tell her? The doctor told me she's only slightly more capable than a child to handle her affairs. So, oh, my God, what am I going to do? I can't bear to tell her. But like they don't really, that scene is almost a noble thing rather than like it's kind of fucked up that this lady doesn't know what's happening to her because she's been infantilized. It's they don't have any of those flaws. They're not sexist, they're not racist, they're not bigoted in any way. They're just good people, because that's what good, even in the deep 30 South, good people wouldn't be racist. And then like, you know, again, the one flaw of the justice system was a John Coffey, but who can blame him? I mean, he's this huge black guy that's screaming his head off with two dead girls in his hands. Like, it's entirely, the movie's almost like it's entirely understandable that this flaw happened. And honestly, the good men were ready to undo it. But John Coffey says, nope, we can't do any of that foolishness. I got to die because I'm just too tired, boss. I'm too tired of living. You know, the old man river. He starts that shit up. And yeah, and then you contrast it to bad people who there's no explanation. There's no bad childhood. Percy came from a wealthy, entitled family. They're just evil. They're mm-hmm. just fucking evil. There's bad. And like I said, I think at least one is coded, at least a little gay. Maybe both of them, because it seems like Wild Bill is very much into fucking boys, too. And one mm-hmm. of them's a heinous pedophile. So, like, they get their just deserves. And again, I'm not cynical enough that this stuff ruins the movie for me, but I think you'd be foolish not to at least point out that this is, in a lot of ways, ass backwards way of looking at things. And even again, you know, when I first saw this, I was a lot more conservative than I am today. And it kind of pried my mind open of like, man, it is kind of fucked up that we kill people. It's fucked up that we got this death row. What if death row was administered by some just normal person? Like, what if it wasn't a saint? And then if it's just a normal, what if it's just ran by a fucking sadist? Oh my God. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it doesn't really, it's almost like the, I think it's a very conservative critique of like, yeah, there's problems in the system, but you could solve them with good people. You just got to get the right people pulling the levers. You got to get the right people wetting the sponges. You got to get the right people serving as a jury of John Coffey's peers in 1930s Louisiana.
Well,
and you wouldn't have these problems, right? But it's fucked up at a systemic level. And the opposite would happen. You put guys like Tom Hanks in it, and he will be burnt out and a cog in the wheel and a real probably shitty human being within 5 years of doing that job.
Yeah. So C&E David Simon work.
Yeah.
Yeah. The closest it ever gets to any kind of commentary on how messed up the system is when John Coffey, like, they're saying, hey, is there any way out of this for him? Can we, the state's not going to overturn their verdict.
I had a religious experience that proves the innocence of this man. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. How do you submit new evidence based on those grounds? You can't. So even if he is innocent, the state is not going to recognize it. That's as close as they get to it, but it's a brief moment in a 3-hour and 9-minute movie. It's like a line.
Yeah. So you'll notice that this shared a lot of flaws with because like in Shawshank Redemption, one of the primary critiques of there is like the movie is essentially a black man witnessing a white man's liberation that then the white man helps free the black man who couldn't do it on his own. And again, I love Shawshank. It's a great movie. But like you can enjoy things and still be aware of the fact that they have maybe, you know, these elements that are I think the problem is it is like these narratives run counter to the spirit of the movie that like if you take the lessons just from what the movie's teaching you, you won't be equipped to solve the real problems that it's trying to tackle. You know,
this is definitely a fantasy movie. I don't think every movie needs to be a critique and takedown of the system either. I think
that's exactly right.
Yeah, I can enjoy movies for what they are. While also recognizing flaws, both maybe in the film itself, but also in the systems around that the film deals with. So, this doesn't need to be, an in-depth investigative report on the justice system in America. It can just be a Tom Hanks, Michael Clark Duncan vehicle for some excellent acting and some high emotion.
Oh, yeah, it definitely gets there. All right, well, that wraps us up for Bald Move Prestige this week. Listener, did you know that almost every week we give our Patreon audience, our executive producers, an option? We give them 3 movies that we could talk about. The producers overwhelmingly selected Green Mile for this week out of the slate of 3 movies that we curated. If you want to get in on some of that steering of the Prestige feed, and if we ever get overloaded with Prestige, steering the Pulp feed. It's one of the many benefits from being a club member. Go to support.baldmove.com to find out more about that. And we will see you with another Prestige film real soon. Until that time, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.